On the 16th of May 1926, at a public meeting in Dublin's La Scala Theatre, Fianna Fáil was founded by Eamon de Valera and his supporters, starting a journey that would make it the dominant force in Irish political life. For long stretches of the 20th century, Fianna Fáil did not only compete for power, it shaped how Irish politics was conducted. Yet its history is not merely one of electoral successes, governance and longevity. It's also a story of ambition, controversy, conflict, reinvention and periodic crisis. So as Fianna Fáil reaches its centenary, we're going to explore aspects of its history, its culture and its role in government. This evening I'm joined by three guests who have long studied and written about Irish politics. Donacha O'Bechan, Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government, Dublin City University. He's the author of Destiny of the Soldiers, Fianna Fáil, Irish Republicanism and the IRA, 1926 to 1973. Rona McGreevy, news reporter with the Irish Times, is editor of a new book, Sean Lamass, The Lost Memoir, and Owen O'Malley, Associate Professor in Political Science at the School of Law and Government, Dublin City University, is the author of Charlie versus Garrett, The Rivalry That Shaped Modern Ireland. You're all very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Donacha, let's start with you. Let's start at the beginning. It's May 1926. De Valera is about to found this new political party, Fianna Fáil. Why had he waved goodbye to Sinn Féin? What was he hoping to achieve with this new political party?
Well, there's not even a consensus on that. There are many different versions, but there was an Ordesh shortly before in March, a Sinn Féin Ordesh, and Eamon de Valera was the president of Sinn Féin. He was hoping to get the Sinn Féin party to isolate the misgivings it had about the Free State to the Oath of Allegiance, as it was called. And this was an undertaking that one had to give to get entry to Dáil Éireann. And there was a counter motion by Father Michael O'Flanagan, which said that it was incompatible with Sinn Féin principles to enter a legislature established under British law. And that passed narrowly. Therefore, De Valera's initiative had been defeated and he left the meeting. Now, if you believe the official version, he left the meeting without a penny and without a clear plan. And he spoke to Sean Lamass and he said, well, that's it. I'm out of politics. And he was petitioned by Lamass to kind of continue and to create a new organization dedicated to his idea of isolating, as I said, Republican objections to the state, to the Oath of Allegiance. And if they could get the Oath of Allegiance removed, that they would then try and take their fight into Dáil Éireann. And that was the background. So it was from a split, one that wasn't necessarily acrimonious. And indeed, Lamass himself said he wasn't really sure if De Valera wanted to win that motion of the Sinn Féin Ordesh. There's that legendary quote that Sinn Féin, according to Lamass, had accumulated a galaxy of cranks and that De Valera was kind of happy to see the back of a lot of them. And that he'd actually, you know, said to people, look, you can vote against this motion as your common as directed, but then I'm going to establish something afterwards and you can be part of that. So there's kind of two different versions in a way. There's the official narrative, which presents this almost neophyte De Valera, this amateur who kind of almost by accident establishes Fianna Fáil. But I think most people who've looked at it would concede that he had been planning this for some time and that he was no neophyte and that he'd managed to put his men into key positions within the party, and more importantly, perhaps abroad, because at this time, very different perhaps from today, most of the money that was going to Sinn Féin and would go to Fianna Fáil for several years was coming from the United States of America, to a lesser extent Australia. For example, the 1927 Ordesh report of Fianna Fáil indicates that 98% of its funding came from abroad. Only 2% was raised locally. That was something, of course, they were going to have to change.
Hmm. And then comes Fianna Fáil's entry into Dáil Éireann. That was in August of 1927. How important was that moment, both for De Valera's aims and indeed for the state itself?
Oh, it was crucial. And I mean, De Valera very skillfully, I think, presented what was a tactical retreat that he was forced into as somehow a major step forward for the revolution. He, of course, wasn't the first to suggest that the oath wasn't perhaps an oath of religious importance, that it was an undertaking. And some people like Patrick Belton, for example, had gone in before him, but they'd all been admonished by the newly founded Fianna Fáil party. But it was difficult for Fianna Fáil in that kind of early year because they were, you know, a party with more than 40 members, but they hadn't a parliament to go to. And they did kind of ostentatiously go to parliament buildings, trying to get in and were prevented from entering. But what happens and what changes everything is the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins in August 1927. Now, there had been an election in June. Fianna Fáil had done very well. And it seemed from Cumann na Gael's perspective, the government, that it was a masterstroke in calling another election for September. They thought that their opponents would be financially exhausted. They were right in the case of Sinn Féin and Labour and others. But Fianna Fáil, again, with that diaspora funding, were well prepared for that. And the legislation that accompanied the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins made it clear that for anybody to stand for election, they would have to in advance give an undertaking that they would take their seats in the Dáil. So essentially, Fianna Fáil, very new, but De Valera, of course, a seasoned politician, were faced with bowing out of Irish politics forever or essentially swallowing their pride and going into the Dáil. And that legitimised Dáil Éireann overnight. I mean, and Cumann na Gael's, of course, position became rather precarious because they didn't have a solid majority. So it created the two-party system in many respects that we were to emerge. Many people then took sides that had been sitting on the fence, independents and smaller parties. They gravitated over the coming years either to Cumann na Gael or to Fianna Fáil.
Now, there's the famous, notorious, I suppose, quote by Sean Lamass describing Fianna Fáil as a slightly constitutional party. What was he talking about there? Was he talking about Fianna Fáil's continuing relationship, perhaps, with the IRA? Or was he talking about the constitution, the 1922 constitution of the Irish Free State?
No, it's clear if you read the full passage, and this is in keeping with many Fianna Fáil statements at the time in the Dáil between 1927 and 1932 when they come to power, that he was essentially questioning the legitimacy of the state and genuflecting towards the IRA and the larger Republican movement of which Fianna Fáil considered itself a part. I mean, De Valera himself said that they had entered a faked parliament that didn't have legitimacy. And, you know, I mentioned Kevin O'Higgins' assassination. I mean, De Valera was very careful when he was condemning it because he said that he thought that no Republican organization was responsible for it, because he knew that, you know, there were Fianna Fáil members who were involved in that assassination, most notably Timothy Coughlin, you know, who himself died a year later. So, you know, right up until they took power in 1932, for example, Fianna Fáil were attending the annual Bowdenstown commemoration, which was banned by the government, and yet tens of thousands would go to it. But in 1932, when they come to power, they participate in the state one. Frank Aiken, as Minister of Defence, leads the Free State Army in the Bowdenstown commemoration, which then they start saying is the annual traditional commemoration to Wolfe Tone. But up until that point, they had a very close relationship with the IRA. And indeed, up until 1933, the IRA is calling for its members to vote Fianna Fáil. And of course, there's that wonderful newspaper headline from 1932, the election, where the Irish Independent proclaims that the gunmen and the communists are voting Fianna Fáil before asking, how will you vote?
Okay, so let's, obviously De Valera comes in for so much attention and has come in for so much attention, but let's stick with Sean Lamass. And Ronan, you published just recently a book of interviews given by Lamass, which provide great detail of his life in politics, greater detail really than we've ever had before about Lamass, because we have surprisingly little about Lamass. Tell us about the recordings. Where do the recordings come from? How did you come by them in the first place?
Well, between 1967 and 1969, Sean Lamass recorded 23 separate interviews, very long interviews with Dermot Ryan, who was a businessman and a member of the Fianna Fáil National Executive, with a view to this being his authorised biography. And Lamass had sight of the transcripts and the recordings. He made notes in relation to it in November 1970. He said that it was working out much better than he ever expected, and he was happy to go along whatever Ryan wanted to do with the recordings. Well, unfortunately, Lamass died in May 1971, and then Dermot Ryan had this big project that he was going to publish this book himself, which was a huge undertaking in the 1970s, and he basically, his businesses, he was a tourism operator, his businesses ran into trouble, and the book never materialised in his lifetime. But he handed over the transcripts and the tape recordings to the Lamass family in the last decade, and they handed them over to UCD archives in 2018. But before that, they gave them to me, and we published a supplement on them in May 2018 in the Irish Times. It was always my intention to go back and to create this into a book format at some stage. So that's where we are today.
273,000 words. Yeah. That would have been one hell of a book. So you had to do a little bit of, or quite a bit of editing.
I did have to do a lot of editing, but the whole lot of it is interesting. I mean, I just had to make it into a readable format, and obviously 270,000 words. I mean, if you think that the average non-fiction book is 90,000 words, you're looking at a 3 or 4 volume series. So I picked what I felt was the most relevant parts of the book.
How frank was this interchange between Lammas and Ryan?
Incredibly frank. Lammas, I think you would say in modern parlance, he had no filter. When he was asked a straight question about anything, he gave a straight answer. He wasn't trying to gainsay whether how people would react to what he was saying. He was very critical.
At this stage, of course, he's out of politics.
He's out of politics, but he actually isn't, because he's a TD till 69, but he's still the sort of, you know, the big beast in the Fianna Fáil firmament, you know. But he's really candid about so many different politicians, De Valera being one. He said that Jack Lynch lacked sort of impact with the public. He felt that Noel Brown was essentially a crank. Paddy Smith, who was one of his ministers at that stage, was a troublemaker. I mean, I don't want to go into the whole negative aspects of it, but he was very candid about the failings of other politicians and, of course, of himself as well. He was quite hard on himself in the book.
In popular memory, obviously, Sean Lammas is chiefly remembered as Taoiseach, but he had a long, long history in Fianna Fáil. We've just heard from Dunica that, you know, he was instrumental in the creation of Fianna Fáil. Give our listeners a sort of an overview of Sean Lammas as Minister for Industry and Commerce, Minister for Supply, whatever, before he becomes Taoiseach.
So he had 22 years as a government minister before he became Taoiseach. I would suspect that that is a record. So he had, he was Minister for Industry and Commerce for 16 years between 32 and 48, with the exception of the war, where he was the Minister for Supplies. He also took on the Industry and Commerce role, but that was obviously diminished because of the war. But I mean, I suppose, you know, you look at an awful lot of semi-state bodies that are still around today, like Aer Lingus and Bord na Mona, and, you know, he was a pioneer of aviation as well. So all of that stuff is part of his legacy. Of course, during the Second World War, as Minister for Supplies, he had absolutely huge power over people's lives in terms of how people were going to get the necessities of life. So I think the most important period in this history, I certainly in the book, I look at the Lammas era as beginning in 1957, when Fianna Fáil returns to power with an overall majority. I mean, he says in the book at that stage that he was in charge of economic policy in the state. And of course, in 58, you have the famous first programme for economic expansion, which himself and James Ryan, the Minister for Finance, and T.K. Whittaker bring forward. So as he says himself, like, De Valera at this stage is a kind of, he's like a mannequin in the window. I mean, he still has this huge hold over the Irish public in terms of the fact that Fianna Fáil gets an overall majority in the 1957 general election, even though, you know, De Valera is an old man at this stage, but he's still the figurehead for the Fianna Fáil movement. And that actually, as Lammas actually says, that really suited him, because he could do the work that he needed to do in terms of economics while De Valera was still the Taoiseach.
But had the fact that De Valera essentially had gone on too long, when Lammas takes over in 1959, did that fact make his job so much more difficult when he becomes Taoiseach?
Well, this is one of the candid things that Lammas says in the book, that really De Valera should have gone after 48, and that De Valera never brought forward any new initiatives after 48. He was the arbiter between different sections. So by the time he takes over in 59, I mean, the country is facing the 50s, as we well know, was an existentialist period in Irish history, where people were actually seriously questioning the whole benefit of, if you could call it that, of independence. So you had record immigration in the 1950s. You had a series of governments that were insecure, couldn't deal with the problems that the country faced. So when Fianna Fáil takes over in 57, you have, as I said before, the first economic programme. And what Lammas says about this, and I thought it was really interesting, he says the psychological impact of that programme was as important as whatever measures were in it, because basically it was the first time that in the history of the state there'd been an overarching economic program. And the fact that there had even been a program was enough for business people to think, well, maybe we can make a go of it in this country. So that was Lammas's, when he took over in 59, that was his big legacy in terms of trying psychologically, first of all, to to pull the country out of this spiral of depression that had occurred since the end of the Second World War.
In the book, you quote the German, the Nobel Prize winning German author Heinrich Böll, who spent quite a bit of time in Ireland, and he says that Ireland achieved centuries of modernisation between the late 1950s and the late 1960s. Is that pretty much all down to Sean Lemass and Whitaker as well?
No, I wouldn't say that. Neither would Lemass. I mean, you know, the 60s is a period of huge social change throughout the world, and I think one of the things that really catapulted Ireland into the 20th century was the advent of television in 1961. And that happened on Lemass's watch. And in fact, he had been responsible, even though he was very sceptical about television, for ensuring that it was a public broadcaster as opposed to a private one. There was all of that. There was a new mood in the country, I think, in the 1960s, and a mood of optimism that it came into being after the late 1950s. And the best example is that between the 61 and 71 census, the population of the state increases for the first time since the foundation of the state. And, you know, where people are, there's wealth as well. And he was also very good at projecting an image of forwardness for Ireland. You know, he had a lot of very prominent visitors in the early 1960s, obviously Kennedy being one of them, but there was also the visit of Princess Grace in 1961. And then, of course, he's on the front cover of Time magazine in July 1963 with the advanced factories and all the rest behind him. And you juxtapose that with the leprechaun. So even in the 1960s, people were beginning to realise, outsiders were beginning to realise that Ireland was changing under him.
Owen, do you reckon that Lemass's reputation as a moderniser was deserved?
Yes, absolutely. And it was more than just the economy. He modernised Ireland in other ways in terms of the attitude towards Northern Ireland. So before that, there had been what was regarded as a kind of stale anti-partitionist attitude in Fianna Fáil and in Ireland generally. And he kind of realised that, no, we're going to have to start doing something to engage with Northern Ireland unionists. He also modernised the country socially by his appointments to the Supreme Court. So he basically told the Supreme Court judges, he appointed Brian Walsh to the Supreme Court and said, go and find things to do. And that really did have a major impact on Irish society.
He was probably dead by that time it did start to happen, but it did start to happen with the Supreme Court eventually.
If I just might interject here, and Owen, you might speak to this. I mean, I think the biggest thing that he did and the biggest legacy that he had socially in Ireland was the advent of completely free secondary school education in 67, which your great uncle. Yeah, your great uncle, Donough O'Malley, brought in the last months of the Lemass.
I mean, how much did he know about that, though? Because the story, the narrative is that this was entirely Donough O'Malley's initiative and that he took the cabiners completely by surprise. Is that true, do we know?
No, that's not true. I mean, a lot of the work had been actually done by Paddy Hillary in education. He had done most of the groundwork. And in fact, I think Donough went in and said, God, it's a lot cheaper than we expected. Lemass certainly knew about it and approved of it. He didn't maybe know exactly how it was going to be announced to the National Union of Journalists dinner, but he knew of it and approved of it.
Okay. Donough, how important were Lemass's efforts to forge a better relationship with the government of Northern Ireland, the famous meetings with Terence O'Neill? They didn't do Terence O'Neill an awful lot of good, but I mean, how important were they?
Yeah, that's right. There was that famous exchange when Lemass said, I'm going to get into an awful lot of trouble for this. And O'Neill replies, no, Mr. Lemass, it's I who's going to get into trouble. And of course,
that's the
O'Neill
way it
was
worked
right.
Out.
In retrospect, they weren't as important, I think, as they seemed at the time. They were symbolically important. There had been a Cold War. There hadn't been a meeting between a prime minister representing North and South for 40 years. So it broke symbolic ground. But when you look at actually what was discussed and what was achieved, there weren't a lot of meetings. So after those early meetings between Lemass and O'Neill, of course, comes to Dublin just a month or two later. You have to wait until, I think, December 1967 between Jack Lynch having a meeting. And during this time, of course, the North is beginning to boil over because of the issue of civil rights. And that's the one issue that's never discussed. And we can see now that that was perhaps a mistake, but understandable perhaps, because they were worried that were they to bring up those kinds of issues, they would alienate the unionists which they were engaging in. But they did it at the expense of the relationship with Northern Nationalists. Eddie McAteer was the leader of the Nationalist Party, and he was petitioning for meetings at the very same time, saying, look, when you're coming to the North and meeting unionists, could you also reach out to us? And those meetings were not kind of acceded to. And he described their position, Northern Nationalists generally, as one of nobody's children. So at this kind of pivotal moment, you know, the functional cooperation that existed between Dublin and Belfast didn't help offset what we now know was the coming troubles.
Okay, so let's move from Lammas to the son-in-law, Owen, because your book, which is about the relationship or not between Haughey and Garrett Fitzgerald, we'll come to Fitzgerald shortly, but Sean Lammas's son-in-law, Charles Haughey, becomes party leader after Jack Lynch at an extremely turbulent time, both for Fianna Fáil and the country. So take us back, though, to the period before he becomes the Taoiseach, before he takes over from Lynch. That's the infamous arms crisis of 1970, which I think sows the seeds of dissension within Fianna Fáil, which then last into the 1980s.
So Haughey had been a very dynamic minister, very progressive minister and a modernising minister, very much in the mould of his father-in-law, Sean Lammas, who he idolised.
As Minister for Finance.
So he was Minister for Justice first and then became Finance. He ran for the leadership in 1966 when Lammas retired, but withdrew his name when Lammas had kind of indicated that he preferred Jack Lynch to do it. He was incredibly young and incredibly ambitious. But he was a supportive minister for Jack Lynch. He was a modernising finance minister there. And at the start of the Troubles, then some members of the Irish Cabinet got involved in what was essentially an unauthorised... Well, this is all contested, obviously, and I think Dunica may disagree with me on some of this, but he got involved in an unauthorised attempt to import arms that would go to defence committees in the north, which would become the Provisional IRA.
And that then informs, I think it would be fair to say, that informs the later animosities and disputes within the party in the late 1970s and then into the 1980s, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the arms crisis exposes what was probably already there, a split within Fianna Fáil between more consensual nationalists who kind of thought we'll only get the North back through consensus and those who thought violence was still a legitimate way to try and achieve a united Ireland. And so that split happens. At the start, Lynch is clearly the winner of that. Haughey has to kind of lick his wounds. He kind of does a sort of desert crossing moment, but he kind of just gets back with the business. And what he basically does is he starts organising and starts working Fianna Fáil grassroots again.
Yeah, because he's in the wilderness from 1970, basically. And I think one of the ways he gets back, a lot of rubber chicken is consumed, isn't it? He starts grassroots organising, going around the country.
Yeah, so he's driving around Ireland. PJ Mara, his later press secretary, drives him. Liam Lawler, later a Fianna Fáil TD, also drives him. And he drives around the country eating barely edible food in order to sort of ingratiate himself with the grassroots in Fianna Fáil. And it works because by 1977, when Fianna Fáil achieves this huge overall majority, a lot of those people were people that he had helped get there and they regarded themselves as more loyal to Haughey than to Lynch.
So even though Jack Lynch has produced this massive, 84 seats? I mean, it wouldn't be a huge majority now, but it certainly
was. Well,
out
of 144.
Exactly, yeah. It was an enormous majority. But, I mean, things start to go wrong very quickly for Jack Lynch and he ends up resigning. Now, I mean, your book is about Haughey versus Fitzgerald, but the first real battles were within Fianna Fáil. It was Haughey versus Colley, wasn't it?
Yeah, so Colley, who had also wanted to run for the leadership in 1966, was seen as the sort of leader of the old school, possibly the kind of De Valera. He may have been one of these kind of ascetic men, Irish speaker, didn't kind of concern himself with wealth, whereas Haughey was obviously conspicuously wealthy and was a very different type of person, a womanizer. And there were a lot of questions about his the sources of his wealth. And so there was that Colley versus Haughey at the start. They were kind of fighting for the leadership and there was immediately battles within Fianna Fáil because Haughey felt he wasn't being given the loyalty that he felt he deserved, which was true. Colley later admitted it, that he should have been sacked and shouldn't have been allowed to have behaved the way that he did. But he knew that, he was pretty weak at that stage. But a series of battles within Fianna Fáil over the next 4 or 5 years meant that Haughey eventually got complete control over the party.
And all of this, this internal dissension, ultimately leads to one of the great crises for Fianna Fáil, and that is the creation of the Progressive Democrats, obviously with which you have your own familial connection. Des O'Malley, your father, was one of the founders. But it wasn't just Des O'Malley. I mean, there was an exodus, a minor exodus, but a significant exodus from Fianna Fáil.
Yes, it was relatively small. I mean, there had been, 22 and then 33 TDs, Fianna Fáil TDs, voting against Haughey and trying to remove him. But by the time the PDs are formed, there's only 5 or 6 Fianna Fáil TDs leave to create the party. One of them, Bobby Molloy, is a significant figure. But a lot of the other people like Seamus Brennan and Charlie McCreevy, who were kind of expected to go, and David Andrews, didn't. Their loyalty was mainly to the party. But it caused Haughey more trouble because he was craving one thing, and that was an overall majority. He wanted power, and he kept being denied it. And in 1987, he was denied it and went into a minority government.
And Donnacha, how crucial do you think it was that people like the people that Owen has mentioned, Seamus Brennan, David Andrews, Charlie McCreevy, did not defect to the Progressive Democrats? On one level, numerically, that's better for Haughey. But on another level, it means that there is still this force within Fianna Fáil that is very anti-Charlie Haughey.
Yes, but I think a lot of that momentum, those heaves, they dissipate by the end of the 1980s. And, the Progressive Democrats itself, which had a great outing, of course, in its first election with 14 seats, it also begins to dissipate in terms of numbers. It's very hard. This is the experience in Ireland, if you can look back over the century. It's very hard for new parties to emerge and to solidify and to attract supporters, because they're often perceived as one-issue parties. And even going back to, the arms crisis, which was mentioned earlier, and the troubles in the early 1970s, there were attempts like Aintuck there and former Minister Kevin Boland, and they were spectacularly unsuccessful. So Progressive Democrats actually were by far away the most successful, perhaps up until, we'll say, the Social Democrats in more recent times. So it was, I think, by the stage that they'd left, I think Haughey was glad to see the back of them. And I think he'd already won the internal battles. I think Des O'Malley leading that cohort out was a recognition that they had lost the battle within Fianna Fáil and that therefore they could only take the fight outside of Fianna Fáil.
Owen, then the Haughey Fitzgerald era, let's talk about that a little bit. To what extent did that rivalry between Haughey and Fitzgerald shape Fianna Fáil's actions and policies during the 1980s?
So in opposition, Haughey was extremely negative. Gard Fitzgerald was in initially a fairly unstable coalition and then a more stable coalition government with Labour being led by Dick Spring. But everything Haughey tried to do was just to gut Fitzgerald and just to get at him. And one relatively kind of new TD in the party just kind of said, one thing we have to do is just F Garrett. And all they wanted to do was to get at him. And so there was a lot of frustration then within the party because there was a sense that Fianna Fáil wasn't doing the sort of role that it should be doing, which was offering alternative policies. It was just very negative. And it caused Fitzgerald a lot of grief because he was continually trying to second guess Haughey. And he became, in a way, Gareth Fitzgerald had been somebody who had come into politics and he was brimful of ideas and kind of couldn't get them out of his mouth quickly enough. He ended up just being constantly worried about how was Haughey going to react. And so he became a sort of anti-Haughey Taoiseach. And a lot of what he did was designed to prevent Haughey from doing something when he got back into power, as he knew he would.
OK, now obviously there's still a lot of Fianna Fáil history left, but we will leave it at that point because it's politics rather than, I would suggest, rather than history. But with each of you, if you would, starting with you, Donnacha, what do you think that the party's most enduring legacy has been in its 100 years of existence?
Well, that's a big question. I think, look, Ireland is now one of the oldest democracies in the world, and most of the world's population don't live in a democracy. So we have something, I think, to be proud of, something worth preserving. And I think Fianna Fáil played a major role in consolidating that democracy and promoting that democracy. The 1920s was a very difficult decade. I think the government at the time would have said Fianna Fáil and its supporters created some of those difficulties. But they eventually united to form kind of a consensus in Irish society. And I think democracy is now part of the Irish DNA. It's part of the Irish political personality through that kind of localized, you know, constituency politician who represents the state in different parts of Ireland. And I think Fianna Fáil, through its professionalism, through its common network, which was unrivaled, and through its brokerage politics over several decades, gave the state a consensus and a democratic legitimacy that otherwise it might not have had. So I think that's their biggest legacy, I think, to the Irish people, is the embedding of democracy over the course of a century.
Ronan, what would you see as the legacy?
I would completely agree with Donnacha. I think one of the, when you look back on Fianna Fáil, I think it's really interesting that the party that was set up to oppose the state as it was actually turned out to be one of its great defenders. So you have, for instance, as Donnacha said earlier on, once Fianna Fáil got into power, there wasn't going to be no alternative government, no alternative army. And you look at, for instance, De Valera's banning the IRA in 1936, I think it was. De Valera, Lamass, and then Lynch in 1970 were steadfast in their defence of the institutions of the state, like the army and the courts and so on. And I think that we could discuss the bigger Fianna Fáil legacy in terms of economics or whatever, or social policy. But I definitely think the fact that they went from being one of the fundamental opponents of the state to its greatest upholders is just probably its legacy after 100 years.
I mean, they turned out definitely not to be the wild men that was predicted.
Well, I think that's, and I think that's really important when you look back on it in 1932, you had that election, and the whole Cumann na Gael thing was, you know, that these wild men were going to get into power and the state was going to fall, but actually the opposite happened.
Yeah. Owen, your notion of what the legacy is?
Well, apart from the stabilising Irish democracy, which I think Donnacha's right, wasn't important, I think the modernisation of the Irish economy and what we now see as Ireland being a fairly wealthy place in the 1980s, we'll remember it was far from that. And it didn't happen by accident. These were policies, mainly policies pursued by Charles Haughey and Fianna Fáil, that led Ireland to becoming kind of the poorest of the rich to one of the richest of the rich.
Donnacha O'Beachán, Owen O'Malley and Ronan McGreevy, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show this evening to discuss a selection of the personalities and events from Fianna Fáil's first 100 years.